Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and I'm your host for the podcast. Every month or so, I interview the author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'll be interviewing Robert Gerwarth, author of the book Hitler's Hangman, The Life of Heydrich, published by Yale University Press. Gerwarth's biography is part of an impressive recent wave of biographies of Nazi leaders. All are characterized by a thoughtful engagement with recent work on the Holocaust. All attempt to situate their subjects in the world before 1933, and all attempt to depict their subjects as having had real choices to make, that alternative paths were in fact possible. Gerwarth's biography of Heydrich is also distinguished by its particularly effective writing. He synthesizes great amounts of information gracefully while preserving space for anecdotes that illuminate and add color. The result is both enlightening and fascinating. I had a great time talking with Robert this morning. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies. Today, I'm interviewing Robert Gerwarth, author of a wonderful new biography of Reinhard Heydrich titled Hitler's Hangman. The book is a masterpiece of biographical writing, clear, compelling, and insightful. In some sense, its great accomplishment is to leave the reader with a sense of wonder, or perhaps I should say distress. Heydrich, of course, was one of the drivers of Nazi Jewish policy during the Second World War. But, according to Gerwarth, Heydrich lived much of his life without any desire to mistreat or kill massive numbers of Jews and other people. Moreover, his transformation was not inevitable, but contingent, driven by specific life choices and encounters that could have gone very differently. It's a troubling story, magnificently told, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing Robert talk about it. So, Robert, hi, how are you doing today?
How are you, Kelly? Very nice talking to you.
Thank you so very much for talking with us. Why don't we just start the interview by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course, I'm very happy to do that. I am, as you very kindly pointed out in your introduction, a historian of 20th century Germany with a specific interest in the history of political violence, of which there was plenty in Germany's violent 20th century. And I started off, I suppose, by working on political culture in Germany from the foundation of the German nation state in 1871 all the way through the end of the Second World War in 1945. I was interested in history and the history of modern Germany in particular from a relatively young age onwards. I was born in Berlin in the 1970s, so during the time of the Cold War, and it was very difficult actually not to be interested in 20th century history, given that in that place in Berlin, history really surrounds you. And after the end of the Cold War, you could see for the first time, in my case, Eastern Germany as well, with all its scars of the Second World War that had not been removed in a major way, as had been the case in the West. So from a relatively young age onwards, I decided to study history with a focus on these particularly violent years between the First World War and the end of the Second World War.
So how did you come to decide to write a biography of Heydrich?
Well, it had always occurred to me that he was one of the big sort of neglected figures. I mean, we can't really say that the Nazi leadership has been neglected or that the Third Reich has been a neglected subject in the literature. In fact, there are more than 40,000 books that have been published on the Nazi dictatorship, including in more recent years, a large number of very good biographies that seek to bring together biographical approaches with larger structural questions about German society at the time. This includes, of course, Ian Kershaw's magisterial biography of Hitler. It also includes the recent biography of Himmler by Peter Longerich and a couple of others. And Heydrich really is one of the neglected figures in the Nazi leadership. And I always thought he was a particularly fascinating figure, given that he is assassinated when he was still quite young, but already one of the most powerful people in Nazi Germany. He was 38 at the time of his assassination, but had already accumulated a number of key positions within the expanding Third Reich, from being the head of the Gestapo and the Reich Security main office, the kind of think tank of Nazi policies of persecution and genocide, to becoming, just a few months before his assassination, Hitler's deputy in the occupied space of Bohemia and Moravia, in the Czech lands, which was of central importance, of course, to the Nazis because of its armament production and because they firmly believed that this was a space to be included in the future Third Reich. So for all these reasons, I think he's a crucial figure. Of course, he's best known for his central role in devising policies of persecution against the Jews, of being the chairman of the infamous Wannsee Conference in January 1942, and for being in many ways the central figure in the planning and execution of the Holocaust until the summer of 1942.
The other biographies you mentioned, Kershaw's and Langreich, those are both wonderful books. They're also extremely long and detailed and thorough. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about the challenges and opportunities of writing a life of Heydrich that's relatively compact.
Well, I did, of course, have the advantage that Heydrich died in 1942, 3 years before Hitler and Hitler, and that those final years of the Second World War are particularly eventful. So I didn't necessarily have to write about those. I think that Kershaw's biography of Hitler in particular also amounts to, in some ways, a total history of Nazi Germany, which is not necessarily something that I wanted to attempt here. And I think that he has done it in such a wonderful way that this was no longer necessary. What I am focusing on in this book is, I think, someone who will be lesser known to many readers than, say, Himmler and Hitler, precisely because he dies in 1942. People know most about his assassination, but not so much about his early years, his youth, his path towards becoming one of the most powerful figures in Nazi Germany. And for all these reasons, I thought it would be interesting to look at a man who also had a somewhat unconventional path towards Nazism. I think even by 1933, very few people would have been able to predict that he would grow into that very dark role in the Nazi dictatorship, or that even the Gestapo or the SD, the security service of the SS, would become such a powerful institution over the course of the Second World War. And of course, the SD is very much his brainchild. In fact, the SD starts as a one-man enterprise, with him being the only employee.
Let's start with that basic kind of claim, which I found very persuasive, that no one would have imagined that Heydrich's life would have turned this way. How does he grow up? What's his family background?
Well, he is in some way similar to Himmler in the sense that he comes from a very privileged background. His parents are both professional musicians. In fact, his maternal grandfather is already a very successful musician and founder of one of the most successful and most widely acclaimed conservatories in Germany. His father then opens up a similar business in the Prussian city of Halle. Again, a great commercial success. It is a time when middle-class families begin to invest very heavily into the musical education of their children. So he really grows up in a both cultured and affluent environment. He's very protected, very sheltered, and privileged in every possible sense. All of that is not fundamentally unusual. I mean, many senior figures in the SS in particular would actually come from similar backgrounds, would also be university graduates, which Heydrich is not, for reasons which we can discuss later on. But he's certainly coming from a cultured and well-educated family background. His family is not particularly nationalist or anti-Semitic either. So any attempt to sort of trace his anti-Semitism, which he very clearly embraces in the 1930s and spearheads in many ways, kind of genocidal anti-Semitism, it is impossible to trace that back to his early childhood or to his sort of parents' influence in any way, shape or form. What is interesting, perhaps, and the only connection in some ways to anti-Semitism, is that his youth is overshadowed to a certain extent by a rumor that his family is actually Jewish. This rumor first sort of emerges when Heydrich is already a teenager, and it stems from it originates from a pupil of Heydrich Senior's conservatory who's expelled and then who generates in return in an act of revenge this rumor that Heydrich's paternal grandmother is Jewish because she had the Jewish sounding name Zeus. And this rumor actually sticks with Heydrich for the rest of his life. It is perpetuated by various people who have had an impact on his life and his career. Later on, even after the Second World War, by some former SS associates who tried to turn the argument on its head in a way, sort of coming from a very clearly anti-Semitic position themselves, to say that only a Jew could come up with something as devious as the Holocaust. So this is sort of the, in some ways, the logic of the an inverted logic of anti-Semitism. But throughout Heydrich's career, this rumor resurfaces time and again. And when it first emerges, his parents actually sue the person who has spread it and win that law case, a court case. And I think they do it less because they are fundamentally anti-Semitic, but because in a climate where latent anti-Semitism is omnipresent, a businessman like Heydrich Senior has to worry about being seen as a Jew, as someone who only does that for it runs his business for money. So that's, I think, the main reason why he decides to sue the person who's spreading that rumor. But apart from that, there's no indication that the Heydrich family is particularly anti-Semitic. If anything, because Heydrich's father is a Catholic and his mother as well, they are part of a small minority themselves in the overwhelmingly Prussian Protestant town of Halle at the time. So they would have had to have some understanding what it means to be a part of a small and since the Kulturkampf of the 1870s, often beleaguered minority in Germany.
And remind us when he's born?
He's born in 1904, which is relatively interesting. I mean, people like Michael Wild, who is a wonderful historian of the Third Reich, have pointed to that generation born between 1900 and 1910, the so-called war youth generation, a generation that was too young to actually fight in the First World War, but to fantasize about that war, about that conflict, about participating in that conflict without being able to actually engage in physical combat. They would romanticize the experience of the war. And Heydrich is very much part of that generation. He's too young to be drafted into the German army during World War I, and he experiences the German defeat and the subsequent revolution in 1918-19 as a teenager. All of these events, of course, leave, I think, a very strong impression on him. But again, Heydrich is unusual in the sense that he, again, does not perceive the experience of the revolution and the defeat of Germany as a sort of fundamental turning point that transforms him into a Nazi in the waiting. Lots of other future senior SS and Nazi figures do actually portray this either retrospectively or in their diaries and letters written around 1918 as a major turning point. Hitler himself, of course, always refers to the defeat of Imperial Germany in 1918 as the moment of his political awakening, where his homeland, his chosen homeland. Hitler, of course, is Austrian, but he adopts Germany as his fatherland, where that fatherland is defeated. And Heydrich, I think, of course, perceives this as a major slap in the face, and he does participate in sort of Freikorps activities, if only in a very passive way. He never fires a single shot at a communist insurgent during that period of the revolution. But he does become politically more interested. What is, I think, quite remarkable, though, is that unlike most of his future peers in the SS, he does not join any of the staunchly anti-Semitic, staunchly right-wing organizations that mushroom all over Germany at the time.
And so the war, how does the impact of the end, the defeat in the war and the aftermath of the war affect how he thinks his life will go career-wise and education-wise? Because he ends up in the Navy shortly after that, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I think that's less a result of Germany's defeat in the First World War, but a result of the changing fortunes of his family's business in Halle. So his father's conservatory finds it more and more difficult already during the First World War to attract students. Now, with Germany's defeat and the subsequent inflation and major economic crisis that Germany is facing, fewer and fewer people can afford to send their children to a private institution and to pay for the musical education of their children. And the Heydrichs are really feeling the effects. Before 1914, before the outbreak of the First World War, they had a lot of income, and Heydrich Sr. invested a lot of that income into the family business again. After 1918, and particularly during the major economic crisis, during the hyperinflation of the of 1923, the business is really feeling the effects of the lost war and of the economic recession. This is already becoming clearer and clearer in the first post-war years, and as a result of that, it becomes evident that Reinhard Heydrich will not be able to inherit the family business, that he has to look for an alternative career. And he finds that in the Navy. Which is again perhaps somewhat unusual because Halle does not necessarily have a direct connection to the sea. And people have speculated for quite some time why he would have chosen that particular career path. I can't say that I can offer the definitive answer to that question because of a lack of sources on that issue. But of course, after the end of the First World War and after the self-sinking of the German fleet, being an officer was still a very highly prestigious career path for a German to pursue. And I think that is what attracts Heydrich in some ways. Also, of course, the lack of combat experience in the First World War here is a way of sort of discovering the world on a boat, experiencing, you know, having adventures, being having chosen a respectable career for the eldest son of a middle-class family in Germany at the time.
And he spends a short time in the Navy, and then he's kicked out. And well, that's a rather interesting tale.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think – I mean, he certainly didn't have the best of times in the Navy. And that is perhaps an interesting sort of addition to what I already said. He – within that staunchly nationalist milieu of the German Navy after 1918, which is partly staunchly nationalist because they want to overcompensate for the fact that the revolution of 1918 started in the Navy, in Kiel. And within that – staunchly nationalist milieu, Heydrich is widely seen as a liberal, as someone who is not sufficiently nationalist, which is, of course, quite ironic given his future career. And I think it's an important period for him because it makes him more aware of his weaknesses as an apolitical person. But what is the crucial turning point in his life? Indeed, comes when he meets first of all his future wife, Lena von Austen, who at this point in the later 1920s is already a staunch supporter of Hitler, one of the so-called early supporters of Hitler, which means that she started to support Hitler and to become a member of the Nazi Party even before the Nazis experienced their breakthrough in the wake of the Great Depression after 1929. She has a major ideological influence on him and would later, after his dismissal from the Navy, direct him towards the Nazis and particularly towards the SS. What brings about his dismissal is the fact that at the time when he's already seeing his future wife, Lena von Austen, he's already involved in a relationship with another woman who considers herself engaged to Heydrich. So when he gets engaged to Lena, he sends out a message about the engagement to everyone he knows, including that woman who, as a result, experiences a nervous breakdown, and informs her apparently very influential father, who submits an official complaint to the Navy leadership. As a result, he is then summoned in front of a naval honor court. I think in that situation, all that Heydrich had to be worried about was maybe demotion or a slap on the wrist. But what was even worse than the fact that he was simultaneously engaged to two women was the fact that he behaved in a very arrogant way towards the honor court. So instead of admitting that he was wrong and then instead of protecting the reputation of the woman in question, he accused her of completely misrepresenting the relationship, that he had never made a promise of engagement. And he also behaved very arrogantly towards the members of that honor court. As a result, and this was quite a big step at the time, the court recommended to the commander-in-chief of the German Navy that Heydrich should be dismissed. The commander-in-chief, Admiral Rieder, follows the suggestion and dismisses Heydrich from active service. So what that means is that Heydrich, at the height of the Great Depression, finds himself, this is we're talking about 1931, finds himself without a job. His family business back in Halle is almost bankrupt at this point, so his own family can't support him financially either. And now, under the influence of his future wife, what happens then is that he hears about a job offer, or a job vacancy, rather, in Munich as a sort of staff officer within the relatively small and insignificant SS. So he's being put in touch with Heinrich Himmler, and they agree to meet for a sort of job interview outside Munich. They meet, and Himmler is immediately impressed by the young ex-naval officer who he meets on that fateful day, where their quite deadly kind of cooperation takes its beginning. He's not only impressed by the sort of physical appearance of Heydrich, who of course looks very much like the ideal Nazi, but also impressed by his military bearing. The meeting is actually based on a misunderstanding. Himmler thought that, for a variety of reasons, thought that Heydrich had served as an intelligence officer, and he is trying to recruit for a person who would be able to set up the SS's own intelligence service, the future SD. So even though he finds out relatively quickly that Heydrich is a communications officer and not an intelligence officer, he still decides to hire him. And from then onwards, Heydrich gradually becomes the most important associate of Himmler's. He, although Himmler never had officially had a deputy, Heydrich fulfills that role for the next years until 1942.
Yeah, I'm struck by your discussion of his relationship with Himmler and their close partnership. What is it about the two that made them get along so well, and how did that working relationship work?
Well, many historians in the past have always suggested that there was a rivalry between these two. Mm-hmm. And I think in coming to that assessment, they have relied uncritically on the statements of former SS officers after 1945, who tried to construct this rivalry, if you like. They always suggested that Heydrich was so ambitious that ultimately he wanted to replace Himmler. I've come to a very different conclusion. I think that the success, in inverted commas, the success of the SS is very much down to these two men and the way in which they collaborate and cooperate. I think that they have complementary talents in some ways, Himmler being the sort of visionary of the SS, the ideologue, the person who came up with certain policy ideas, but also someone with arguably a lot of social skills, you would say. One wouldn't guess that, but I think that comes through very clearly when you read the excellent Himmler biography by Peter Longerich. People always saw him as someone who's very awkward, but actually he's very clever in his dealings with his own family, if you like, with his own SS family. He plays a very sort of fatherly role within the SS. He reprimands, but he also sets presents. He promotes, he makes sure that, you know, problems like alcoholism are resolved to a certain extent. So he does play a sort of fatherly figure, and he's also very good at maintaining strong connections with other powerful Nazis, something that is essential, of course, in the Third Reich. Heydrich, by contrast, is not the most social character. he doesn't like social gatherings. He doesn't particularly like attending meetings with other senior figures. But he is a very talented organizer. He's someone who is needed by Himmler for the implementation of his policies. That's something he's very good at. And he's also very good at identifying young raw talent, which he sort of increasingly brings into his orbit and places them in his own sort of power apparatus in the, you know, running the Gestapo, particularly later on running the Reich Security Main Office and the SD. So these are all sort of talented, ambitious young graduates. I mean, what I always found quite striking was the relative youth of these people. People in their 30s who suddenly have an incredible amount of power. And Heydrich encourages that and encourages initiative, encourages these people, almost like a modern manager, to show initiative in their radicalism in order to rise through the ranks. And he rewards initiative. So I think he's that perhaps helps to explain why these two men are relatively successful, because by 1933, when Hitler comes to power, it is absolutely far from clear that the SS will play a major role. After all, they are still subordinate to the SA at this point.
I was struck because you talk about his leadership qualities, and you describe his leadership style as impulsive and bullying, and I think you quote somebody as saying it was despotic. Is his reward of initiative and his opening up of opportunities to the people who work under him, is that why people will work with him so successfully anyway, even if perhaps not happily?
Well, if you look at the statements that people make, both after 1945 but also during the war, you do get the very strong impression that people fear him and admire him at the same time. Mm-hmm. He's someone who, certainly people within the SS, he's certainly someone who actually lives the sort of ideals that the SS is preaching, in the sense that, you know, he doesn't drink and smoke, which is very unusual at the time. Mm-hmm. He's someone who gets up very early in the morning and works very hard and is very active in terms of sports and really tries to live up to the expectations of an SS officer. So he wants to lead by example, and I think that people admire that in a certain way. At the same time, he's also a very despotic leader. He's someone who punishes his officers if they don't do what he wants them to do. And I think that sort of creates a specific atmosphere within the SS leadership core, where people, because they want to kind of anticipate almost anticipate what Heydrich wants from them, they are inclined to use more and more radical means to achieve that.
Yeah, and that's a really important part of your argument as we go along. Let me pause here, because if I'm reading the book right, he seems to have something of the same ambiguous relationship with his wife, that their marriage was stormy, and yet Lena, at least at the end, claimed to have been devoted to him. How would you characterize his marriage?
Well, I think when they first meet, they are very much in love, and Lena has a, as I said before, a strong influence, intellectual or ideological influence on him, because up until the late 1920s, Heydrich is perhaps best described as an apolitical person. He's more interested in his career than in any specific ideology. So I think in the beginning there's, you know, a lot of love and also a lot of influence from Lena on Reinhardt. I think that changes increasingly when Heydrich's career in the Third Reich takes off, because he's an absolute workaholic. He's hardly ever at home. And that changes, I mean, that changes even more dramatically, of course, after the beginning of the Second World War, when he really is never at home at all. And she complains about that frequently, and quite rightly, I suppose, about his absences, but also about her suspicion that he has affairs all the time, which is something that is impossible, of course, to prove in a meaningful way. I mean, there are lots of rumors, and lots of, you know, former SS associates would support that statement that Heydrich had lots of affairs during the 1930s. But it's difficult to say that with certainty. I mean, after all, we're talking about the head of the criminal police and the Gestapo. So if there were any files on that, or any these public statements made before 1945, they are quite likely to have been destroyed.
The next section of the book is titled Becoming Heydrich, which seems to me in some ways one of the really critical points you make, is that he becomes a quote-unquote Nazi after he joined the Nazi Party. Can you talk about how and why he became Heydrich?
Well, I think he realizes quite quickly that he's been given a second chance. 1931, the year of his dismissal, really is the lowest point of his life, where he has no future. His marriage is actually being questioned, that they're not married yet. And so his parents-in-law, of course, view the prospect of their daughter getting married to an unemployed ex-naval officer with great skepticism, and say, you know, you have to get a life and a career first before you can marry our daughter. But also after 1933, the sheer boundless opportunities that present themselves. So there is an element of careerism, but I think the Nazi ideology also helps him to understand why his life collapsed in certain ways, in economic ways, but also other ways. Before 1933, he can blame the Weimar political system, he can blame the Jews. So Himmler's binary ideology, sort of a worldview that divides everything into black and white, helps him, actually. It helps to reduce the complexity of life, and makes it possible for him to say, you know, this political system is responsible for the economic collapse of my father's business, for the end of my career, and so on and so forth. And we also, I think, have to understand that from 1932 onwards, he is surrounded by people who have worked for the Nazi movement for a long time. So he's the newcomer. He's someone who hasn't got an ideological or political track record. Many of these people have served in Freikorps corps. Many people have served time in prison for their political convictions. So in order to demonstrate his commitment to the case, to the course of Nazi ideology, he needs to be more radical than everyone else. He understands that very quickly. He's also that time when the rumor about his sort of Jewish family origins resurface. So all of a sudden, people talk, even within the Nazi party, about him being a quarter Jew, which is, of course, well, if not a death sentence, certainly something that would have terminated his career and therefore sort of ended his second opportunity to make a life for himself. So I think all these points are actually quite important in explaining why Heydrich becomes such an increasingly radical figure. He is really reinventing himself as a model Nazi in the 1930s, a process which I think lasts up until 1936. So what I'm trying to argue against, I suppose, is to see Heydrich purely as an opportunist, as someone who grasps this second chance and doesn't actually believe in it, which is what lots of historians have actually said in the past, that he is he's a special case because he doesn't believe in Nazi ideology. And I don't think that's true. I think, you know, from the mid-1930s onwards, he had convinced himself that this new movement, which he was supporting actively for which he was increasingly willing to die even, that ideology behind it was correct, and that he should do whatever he could to further the Nazi movement.
And he has rather an extraordinary rise in the 1930s from a position of relative insignificance to being one of the major power figures in the regime. How does that happen?
Yeah, no, I mean, his rise is quite remarkable. Here again, I think it is important to look at Heydrich and Himmler together, because they are climbing through the ranks together. Again, something which I would say contradicts the argument that there is a tension between them. There was no particular reason why Heydrich should have tried to undermine the position of Himmler, because to a large extent, he owed his entire career to Himmler, and he was extraordinarily loyal, and Himmler knew very well that he could rely on that loyalty, and you know, both people never forgot that, actually, until the very end, until 1942. So yes, absolutely. I mean, the ascent of Heydrich is rather remarkable. Again, we have to bear in mind that he was only 38 at the time when he was assassinated in Prague. You know, for someone in his position, someone who was then in charge of the Holocaust, of Jewish prosecutions, but also of the main instruments of suppression in Nazi Germany and in the occupied territories, that is quite remarkable. I think that's the kind of career that is only possible in a totalitarian dictatorship.
And is this ascent a kind of strategic approach by Heydrich? In other words, does he set out at some point, sit down with himself and make a career goal of becoming one of the most important players in the Nazi regime? Or is he responding to opportunities as he goes along? Or, and here I want to recognize that we can't ignore the pairing of Heydrich and Himmler, but is this intentional, or is this just a kind of reaction to circumstances as they arise?
Well, he's certainly a very ambitious figure, but I don't think that there was a master plan in any shape or form. He is responding to circumstances and to opportunities that present themselves along the way. And he and Himmler are cunning enough to seize these opportunities when they present themselves. I don't think there is a master plan at all. I mean, looking or describing alive in Nazi Germany also always has to sort of reckon with and describe the circumstances under which these careers are possible. What is interesting, though, is that the SS leadership, I think, demonstrates or rather constitutes a rather different leadership from the established civil service. Yeah. If you look at the age structure alone, you'll see that most of the leadership core of the SS is much younger than the rest. And of course, as a result of that, we know from sociologists of violence that people who are young tend to be more radical than those who are older. I think in part, at least, helps to explain the radical initiative which these people present. And for them, there is a historical opportunity, particularly after the outbreak of the Second World War, to completely redo the map of Europe and to fight and destroy the perceived or real enemies of Germany once and for all. And they want to seize that opportunity. So there is a sense of historical opportunity which they are determined not to let go.
I was just going to ask, I was interviewed Donald Bloxham a couple months ago, and he has an interesting section in his book about the Nazi project. Does Heydrich, by the end of the 30s, have a kind of coherent vision of the Nazi project?
Well, I think that the nature of the Nazi project changes constantly. Mm-hmm. I think that even Heydrich and Himmler at the beginning of the Second World War did not anticipate the Holocaust in its real form. I mean, of course, to be absolutely sure that I don't get misunderstood, I mean, they never have any positive plans for the Jews of Germany or Eastern Europe. But they believe in often violent, often forced expulsion as the major aim of SS Jewish policy. And that becomes more and more dramatic and much more violent and genocidal over the course of the Second World War. As you know, lots of books have been written about the exact timing when sort of local genocides become a pan-European genocide. And it is perhaps impossible to put your finger on an exact date. It is a gradual process that I think really is rehearsed in some ways in Poland, but then becomes in a reality increasingly after the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, after the German attack on the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you to do something which may be nearly impossible in a short interview like this, but you do a wonderful job of kind of outlining the points at which those ideas and visions evolved. Can you maybe briefly summarize the evolution of these ideas from 1938 to 1942 in Heydrich's mind and execution?
Well, of course, again, Heydrich is responding in many way to many ways to opportunities, to the changing historical realities, to the outbreak of the Second World War. First of all, the outbreak of war with Poland, which is, I think, a very important watershed for him, because he is nominally responsible for resolving the Jewish question. But with every expansion of the Third Reich, the problem, you know, self-created problem, which he is responsible, is getting bigger and bigger. So for someone like Heydrich, this is, of course, a major issue, because he wants to be perceived as someone who is extraordinarily successful. And he finds it impossible, and also his Jewish advisors, his entire team that is working on the so-called solution of the Jewish problem, is looking for more and more radical solutions with every expulsion scheme that is failing. So you have these various schemes of and ideas for forced expulsions of Jews from Germany or occupied territories into areas where expulsions are difficult to realize, from, you know, eastern Poland to Madagascar. And it is really in response to the growing, on the one hand, the growing number of Jews under Nazi control, and on the other hand, the lack of any other feasible sort of solution to that alleged problem, that they come up with more and more radical solutions, namely executing them first in certain regions and then later on to a pan-European genocide.
And I was struck by the degree to which the different, at least short-term, visions about how the Jews should be treated and what role Jews should play in this new German Empire, the way in which these different visions among the various power players interacted and frustrated Heydrich's efforts to solve this Jewish problem.
Yeah, no, I think that's, again, it's a very important part of the story. What we do here, I mean, the Nazi Germany has quite rightly been described as a sort of jungle, as a polycratic jungle, as a political institution in which the rivalry between various agencies, various groups, splinter groups, various factions within the Nazi Party, and players in the field in the occupied territories and back home in Berlin radicalized the entire process, largely because radical solutions seem to appeal to Hitler, who, like Heydrich, likes problems to go away when they arise. So ultimately, this favors the SS, which is always proposing the most radical and, again, in inverted commas, scientific solutions to problems, and tries to resolve these problems in a silent way, as opposed to the rather sort of noisy anti-Semitism of the early Third Reich. And I think that's that certainly helps to explain. These processes have been described in wonderful detail by other academics working on the Holocaust in the past. But what I was trying to bring back into the story, I think, is individual agency. Because over the past decades, structural history has taken over completely, so that ultimately individuals don't seem to matter at all anymore. And I was trying to combine the very important findings of structural history with the individual life story of the man who's ultimately in charge of this escalating violence.
And as you did so, I was amazed, to take a brief break from the high politics. Somehow Heydrich manages to take, I guess you would call them, vacations from his job and go be a fighter pilot. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, he's doing that, even though Himmler quite explicitly told him not to. But here again, I think we're returning to the importance, perhaps, of the First World War and the absence of actual fighting experience. Heydrich quite often describes his own role as that of a garbage man, of someone who sort of operates in the shadows, someone who cleans up the Reich and the occupied territories and removes all the undesirables from that space. But he's never someone who's going to, you know, win medals for his actions in the field. And he wants to, through heroic gestures, I call them in my book. He wants to be part of the action, part of the war, particularly at a time when it still looks as if the Wehrmacht is going to win that conflict. So he wants to have part of the action while that's still possible. And of course, that creates all sorts of problems, because there is a real danger that he could be captured. And that he could be captured, particularly on the Eastern Front, which would result into all sorts of problems. But he always perceives himself as a man of deed as well. You know, this is something that the nationalist right always celebrated from the 1920s onwards. Men who don't only talk about change and action and violence, but who actually implement it. And he admires that, and he's very much someone who wants his own team to actively participate in this changing world, and who he sends out all the senior officers of the high security main office into the field to prove themselves, not only to be desk perpetrators, which is of course the image that lots of people had for a long time when they thought about the Holocaust and the SS and the men responsible for the planning of it. I think the opposite is the case. I mean, most of these people are out there in the field commanding SS task forces and have real blood on their hands in a sense.
And so, perhaps somewhat unexpectedly, given his past career, Hitler suddenly appoints Heydrich Reich Protector of Bohemia and Moravia. Why did Hitler do that, and how did Heydrich's policies shed light on his broader ideas about where Europe should go?
Well, I must confess I was puzzled by that decision for a long time, because you know, from Heydrich's point of view, it is on the one hand a promotion, in the sense that he is now only directly responsible to Hitler, only answerable to Hitler as his deputy in Bohemia and Moravia in Prague, which of course in a sort of typical Nazi fashion is a responsibility that he takes on in addition to all his other roles. So it's an accumulation of various offices that that characterizes the Third Reich very much so. He is sent to Prague, I think, for two reasons. First of all, there is an increase in resistance in that space, in that economically very important space. And Heydrich, or rather Hitler believes that Heydrich is the right man to put an end to resistance activities. And he's absolutely right in the sense that Heydrich cracks down very hard on the local resistance and arrests and executes lots of the leading figures in the Czech resistance movement. I think there's a second reason, and that is that the decision to send Heydrich to Prague coincides roughly with Hitler's decision to remove the Jews from the German Reich. And the first three German cities that he chooses are Berlin, Vienna, and Prague. So it is perhaps not a coincidence that he sends the man in charge of Jewish deportations to Prague at this very moment. I think this is the second reason why he's being dispatched there. Heydrich, as usual, goes to this, takes on this task with a lot of energy. He flies back and forth between Prague and Berlin several times a week, often with his own plane, and tries to fulfill both roles at the same time, which seems to be quite successful. At least he likes to portray his own actions as extraordinarily successful in sort of ruling the protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, not only with an iron fist, but I think with a combination of pressure and incentives. So he's trying to convince his subjects his Czech subjects to work with the Reich rather than against it, and that they would receive rewards, monetary, economic rewards in response to that.
And what I found, aside from his efforts to, of course, keep the Czech resistance down and encourage the Czechs to work hard to produce munitions and other industrial supplies for Germany, what I found most interesting about this was his vision of Germanizing the protectorate as part of a broader vision for what a German empire might look like.
Yes, I think it's important actually to connect the Holocaust, or the murder of each and every Jew in Europe, which by the time that Heydrich is firmly installed in Prague has become a reality. So it's already well on its way, even though the final details are only decided on in the spring of 1942. But senior Nazis like Heydrich and Himmler know that this is only the beginning of a more general bloody unweaving of the peoples of Europe. And the main project is, of course, the Germanization of the future territories of the Greater German Reich, particularly the ethnically very diverse territories of East Central Europe. So Germanization, of course, relates to the much bigger project of identifying those parts of the Slavic populations of Eastern and Central Europe who might be Germanizable, who can be sort of retrained, and who have in the obscure view of the Nazis sufficient genetic racial qualities to be subsumed into the German people. And those who would either have to live as slave laborers or be killed off right away. And in some ways, Heydrich is starting during his time in Prague this very process. Not in the sense that he actually kills large numbers of those Czechs he considers ethnically or racially inferior. He doesn't want to upset the populations behind the front at a time when Germany hasn't won the Second World War. Winning the war is a priority, of course. But he begins to classify the Czech population under various covers and to try and to identify those sections of the Czech population that could be absorbed into the German people after Germany's victory over the Red Army.
So the story of the assassination is really quite extraordinary, not just from a narrative kind of thriller standpoint, but from the politics of why the Czech government in exile decided to attempt the assassination. Can you tell us a little bit about why and how Heydrich, that decision was made and how Heydrich ends up being killed?
Yes, the story of the assassination is a very intriguing one, not least because every party involved in the assassination plot refused to accept responsibility after 1945, particularly because of the serious ramifications the assassination had for the civilian population of Bohemia and Moravia. Notably, of course, the German execution of several people, even loosely associated with the assassination plot, people suspected or people who even approved in conversation with their neighbors of the assassination. A protracted process of prosecution and persecution that resulted or culminated in the complete destruction of the Bohemian village of Lidice. I think there are two principal parties that are behind the plot to kill Heydrich. Interestingly enough, the Home Resistance itself is not at all involved. They only learnt about the assassination plot a few days before it happened, and they tried their very best to stop it, notably because they knew that the consequences would be very dire. So the two principal parties involved are the Czech government in exile under Edward Beneš and the Special Operations Executive in London. These two parties have vested interests in a high-profile assassination, partly because the SOE has not had any major successes in inciting resistance activities behind the German lines, which was the purpose why they were founded by Churchill in the first place. And the Czech government in exile is concerned that it looks currently, or from the vantage point of 1941, that the Czechs are not doing enough to work against the Germans in forms of resistance activities and so on and so forth. We have to bear in mind that neither Britain nor France had revoked the Munich Agreement at this point. So it also looked in late 1941 as if Germany was actually going to win the war. So Beneš's post-war project of reestablishing Czechoslovakia as a democratic state was really in danger at this point. So they decide to work together and quickly decide that the right person to kill would be Heydrich, after all, the head of the security services of Nazi Germany. This would really send out a sign to the Western allies and the wider world that the Czechs were doing their bid. So after much preparation, they dispatch a team of parachutists who then spend some time in the protectorate with false identities, and eventually decide that the ideal point, the ideal place to kill Heydrich would be a hairpin curve, the outskirts of Prague, where he passes every day on his way to work from his country estate outside of Prague. He never travels with any security, so it's only him and his driver. And because of the pleasant weather in the spring of 1942, he also drives a convertible, an open-top car. So he doesn't really take many precautions for someone in his position, particularly if we bear in mind that he's someone who's also in charge of drafting security regulations for all senior figures in the Nazi Party and the SS. So he disrespects these regulations completely, and Hitler, after the assassination, is very upset about that and orders senior Nazis to take the necessary precautions. The assassination actually almost failed because although Heydrich is injured, he doesn't die straight away. He only dies of blood poisoning a few days later. So if there had been penicillin or antibiotics at the time, he probably would have survived the assassination attempt. But he didn't, and he died, and the Nazis tried to reinvent him as a martyr of the national cause, as a sort of, the ideal SS man, as someone who who died in active service for the creation of a better world. And really, what we see over the next couple of years, all the way up until 1945, is that he becomes an iconic figure for every aspiring SS officer. The sort of the example that everyone tries to live up to. His pictures are hanging in every training site for the SS, and he's really the model that is held up as someone who lived by SS laws and died by SS laws.
So after spending what I have to believe was a lengthy amount of time kind of deeply immersed in the life of Heydrich, what broader lessons can that life teach us about Nazism and the Nazi period?
That's a very good question. I think what I was trying to do with this book actually was to move a step back from sort of these general sort of statements about lessons to be learned. What I think we can see here is that under certain historical circumstances, people who come from a background that doesn't necessarily prepare you for a career in genocide can become genocidaires if the historical conditions are right. And of course, it takes a certain personality to become someone like Heydrich. It takes a great deal of ambition, false idealism, but also meeting certain people, certain very influential people in his life, like his wife, like Himmler, who I think are mentoring him throughout the 1930s until he becomes the kind of person that he is during the Second World War, the ultra-convinced Nazi and SS man who wants to set an example and who's willing to use ultra-violence to radically reform or transform the world and the ethnic makeup of Europe. So I think what I'm trying to portray here is an individual life within the historical circumstances of the first half of the 20th century. That's kind of the ambition of the book.
We've done a wonderful job, and for our listeners, there's way more in the book than we were able to get into this interview. And I know we've taken a lot of your time, Robert. I would just ask you at the end to tell us a little bit about what you're working on now.
Well, I'm for a brief moment, I'm moving away from the history of the Second World War and to the history of the First World War, or more specifically, I'm writing a history of the aftermath of the First World War, an extremely violent period, actually, during which up to 4 million people die in Central and Eastern Europe, if you include the Russian Civil War. And I think that many of the origins of the Second World War can actually be found in that immediate post-war period, in the sense that you have violent expulsions, not only of Ottoman Greeks, but also ethnic violence is really becoming the norm rather the exception. So you have a period which I think is formative for a new logic of violence that then becomes dominant in the Second World War.
It sounds like a wonderful book in the making. I want to thank you again for all of your time and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
All right. Take care. You've been listening to an interview with Robert Gerwarth, the author of Hitler's Hangman, The Life of Heydrich. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I invite you to come back next time when I'll interview Ron Suni about his recent edited volume about the Armenian Genocide. In the meantime, if you'd like to listen to previous podcasts, you may do so through iTunes or directly from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. Until next time, I hope you have a great month.